What's up, everyone? TJ Schwartz here. You're listening to the Edge and Flow podcast. We are back. We had a little bit of a break. I'm here with Lucas Burnley, my co-host. How you doing, man?
Doing good. I'm excited to be recording. Feels like we've missed a year.
I know it does. I should say this podcast is about knife making, design, manufacturing, art, all the good stuff involving that, CNC machines, and shop
all the little
moves
bits.
And
yeah,
trade
shop
shows.
Moves. Oh, there's so much, dude. This has been, what are we two or 3 weeks out from the last episode?
I don't know. It's probably three
at least.
It's probably three.
Okay. So we're trying to record this every week. And we realize that despite our best intentions, things can and will inevitably pop up. So this has definitely been one of those months. But that leaves us with a bunch of really fun stuff to talk about. Where do you want to start?
Well, I know you went to Blade Show Texas. Do you want to start with that?
Yeah, let's get into it. You've been once, right? You went?
Nope.
Haven't gone at all.
So I went to Texas to visit Tactile like the week before Blade Show.
Got it.
Because I wanted to visit them, and they told me that it'd be hard to visit them during that show, right? Because then they wouldn't be in the shop. So
makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. So, dude, it's an awesome show. I was super, super happy. And I say that it has like an old school feel to it. So right now we have this kind of thing happening with shows where they're either getting really, really big or they're really small.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there's pros and cons to both. So like you and me, as designers, big show is great. Right.
Yeah.
Because we get to see all the companies that we work with. We get to see product that's on the market. We get to really interact inside of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So for other makers, like if that's something you want, like those big shows, like the big Blade Atlanta, like that is, there's a lot of benefit in there. On the other side of the scale, you have like your 4-hour invitational with a bar, and that is high end, low output, like low attendance, but high attendance for the amount of product that's in the room.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
If you're doing high end custom work, that, or like hype work, that's where you want to be probably. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're looking for like a very target rich environment, as far as like very interested people that aren't necessarily as much of a passerby like you might see in the big shows. Yeah,
exactly. You're not going to have someone walk up and think that your table lottery is to win something for free.
Right. Right.
Everybody understands the games. Oh, you're having an auction. Cool. Silent or open. Like, oh, you're doing a lottery. Great. Like people understand it. They understand why they're paying $300 for a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so this is essentially like the inner sanctum of the collecting world. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of makers, it's really attractive because for a lot of us, we don't need 3 days to go to a show. We don't have the output for 3 days. You can sell the product, see the people you want to see, have a really good time, see other makers, and be done.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, this actually kind of leaves this middle ground, which I guess for a while I've been feeling like hasn't existed as much. And I say that like the USN show is in that category where it's big enough that you're at a show. You have some brands, you have a lot of customs, you have small brands that you don't know about, like, but it's really approachable size.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess mentioning USN actually is, I should bring this up too. So USN, since its inception, this is the Usual Suspects network show, has always been in Planet Hollywood in Las Vegas. As of maybe a month ago, they have canceled the show in Las Vegas, for this year, which means they are looking for a new venue, not in Vegas, but it will skip a year. So it'll start up again next year. So kind of what I was saying, which is like, there was already kind of a little bit of a downturn in that type of show. And I think that Blade, Texas fully occupies like that type of space.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great to hear.
Yeah. It's like,
a mid-size is what you're basically describing.
Yeah. But like a mid-size show. And I mean, I'm looking at this like from maker standpoint, obviously, but like also from a collector standpoint, right? Which is, there's a few things that I love to see at a show, which is I really like when I see people that aren't knife enthusiasts, like be able to come in.
Yeah.
Right. But it's cool when it's also at a scale that's not like a massive trade show.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you saw like parents walking around with their kids on Saturday. It's a 2-day show, not a 3-day show. Okay. It is in downtown Fort Worth. Dude, it was great getting out of 20 degree weather and like showing up and it being in like the 70s.
Yeah, it's great.
So
how does that, you went to Blade West, you were there together 2 years ago. How does that compare?
So I would say overall, like size is really comparable, but the energy is different.
And it's this, Texas, so.
It's Texas one, but the collectors that went and the makers that went are a little bit different than what you see at this point in Salt Lake. I think the fact that it's Texas drew a lot of like what I kind of consider as like, you know, my sector of the industry, kind of like elevated EDC side, like kind of tactical, like, you know, Psy Pops and single finger Nux and all this stuff. Right.
Yeah.
It was there. It was like, well represented from a customer standpoint, you know, CBJ, which is Craft Brew Junkies, had a get together. And that to me is like the tipping point for a show where you start to have like the communities roll out. And man, the whole weekend, I was just kind of like this. It felt good going out and like having barbecue afterwards, or like we went to this crazy like country Western bar called Billy Bob's, which is like, it had to be 70,000 square feet or something, like it. Just huge warehouse, but like inside there's like 9 or 10 bars. There's like bull riding, line dancing, like barber, just super fun. If you have the opportunities like that for people to interact and like hang out, that's how you build the community as a maker and as a collector. If you're a collector, be at that, you know, like be in the places with the makers that you want something from.
Yeah.
If you're a new maker, be in the places that have the makers you want to know and the collectors that you want to interact with. And so anytime a show can provide that, I think it's like gold.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. And I've always enjoyed that sort of the atmosphere as far as like the restaurants that fill up and stuff around a show. I've always found to be like some of the most meaningful experiences. Obviously in Atlanta, you have the Pit, which sort of keeps this center of gravity like more dense, but like in Salt Lake, it's a similar thing though. You go to pretty much any bar around
within walking distance,
and there's like, oh, there's the Tops guys, like the whole team is right there at that table next to us. You know what I mean? Like, and then, you know, shooting pool, having conversations, like it's awesome.
It's our scale of networking event that is really good. I was able to, I didn't have a table. I signed up for a table for next year, cause it's good enough. I got really excited. And I would say like the pit is such a unique asset to a show that is partially not even partially, it's environmental. Not every, you know, show venue has a hotel atrium with, you know, in a circle with bars and food.
Yep.
So Salt Lake and Texas, neither one have that, but I think that it's tight enough and the hotels are close enough that you kind of saw people like roll. Like if you went into I stayed at the Omni, it's like you roll into the bar at the Omni, there's people from the show there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, it's kind of at a scale that is approachable, which I really like. The PKA show was a knife show that was in Denver for years, and it had kind of the same thing. It was at a hotel. You'd go into the bar, there'd be people there, but it wasn't a lot of people. It was just, you saw somebody that you knew.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it felt really good. So the only thing I can say is like, it felt like an old school knife show. in a time where like all the shows are changing constantly.
Yeah.
And it was like pretty cool. Nice.
Throwback. Yeah. I've got to go. Keep yeah. telling myself I'm going to. It's like always something weird. Obviously this year was a wild one. Wasn't going to happen this year, but
yeah,
next year. It's always next year.
It might be, you know, I mean, like I have a suspicion that for certain makers, I think that Blade Texas will actually become the priority over Blade Atlanta. Purely because of the scale, the ease of getting there. And I think you can do enough real work there. Whether that's networking or sales or both, that it might make it worthwhile if someone's feeling like, man, Blade Atlanta is just getting like too big. It's too yeah. much.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little more focus on the knives. The other thing that I really loved about it is it was really a good cross section of the industry. So like, if you look at like the stock removal side as a broad spectrum of like, you know, tactical stuff, art stuff, like anything that fits in that, slip joints, whatever. And then you look at like the forging side, there's actually some separation, and not all shows have all kind of
balance.
Yeah. Like they don't have a, yeah, exactly. They don't have a balance of, you know, forged makers or like traditional knives. And this one, it really does. And yeah. it all fits, it all works. And for me, like that creates a certain kind of like, I don't know, like flow for a knife show where like, as a maker, like walking around, you can get inspired by work. It's not like you're in an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything is tactical or everything yeah. is forged. And I want to see like more and more of those crossovers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's know? Fantastic.
So
you talked me into it.
Yeah. Big fan. Dude. I guess let's see, if I was going to give it, if there's any downsides, it would be that there's not a ton of food, like walking distance from the show. Cause you are in like a downtown area. There's enough that you can get a meal, and some of the hotels have like good bars and good restaurants. There's some good steakhouses. But I found myself kind of like ducking out to like go find like barbecue
yeah.
or,
yeah, yeah.
you know, find something like off the main
yeah.
kind of strip.
Less dense.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Dude, had a blast. I think I sent you some crazy pictures.
Yep.
Felt like very Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Texas, man.
Yeah. We got to visit someone's shop that they had a like a 1980s like Hilux pickup truck, really sweet. And they were getting ready to mount a GE minigun in the back for a you know, for a fun rig.
Yeah. Go. Sounds fun.
Yeah, yeah. Very
that's
fun.
Awesome.
So yeah, felt very Texas. All right. So while I was doing that, you were smack dab in the middle of your move, right?
Correct. Yeah. So This is week two of actually making knives in the new shop. So the move, you know, it's always like quote unquote complete with a move until you're about a year later and you actually get the last box opened and organized. You know what I mean? So it's like, we can't call the move complete, but it's been 2 weeks of making knives and it's been going really good. It's smooth in the ways I want it to be, but there always is that, like, every time you turn around to go pick up like a specific tool or something, there's always like, oh, that was in that box, or that's not plugged in, or, you know, there's a weird shadow from the light. We need more light in this spot. You know what I mean? Like it's been a ton of just sort of ironing out of the shop for the last 2 weeks, but we have been producing knives. So it's been hugely eye-opening as far as like what we can do here, I think. So it's been really good. It's been a lot of work, but it's been good.
I mean, the fact that you're up and running inside of 2 weeks, I think for anybody that has moved to shop, is probably pretty impressive. That's, I mean, granted, it's close.
Yeah,
you
that
moved
helps.
In there, you had like everything kind of ready, but still, I think that, so what did the total move, if you've been up and running for 2 weeks, did you move inside of a week?
We lost basically 1 week and then the tail end of another. So
that's insane.
And let me rethink that. Honestly, it was actually, it was like the tail end. We lost the tail end of 1 week and the beginning of the next week. So it was like maybe like 4 or 5 business days that were like jacked up. So it went very smooth. Honestly, there was no, we were very fortunate with the riggers, very fortunate with the electrical, like all the people that helped us do it, you know, as far as like services, they all showed up on time, did their job, except for internet. We're still waiting on the dang internet. So right now we're hotspotting. I guess that's the only thing that we're still waiting on somebody, but all the critical stuff, people showed up, did good work, didn't drop machines, you know, put power where it needed to go. Yeah. So the power
actually, you gave me a little background on like the electricians. That is, dude, that makes it so much easier when you have a team that like hustles and knows what you need, what they need to do, like didn't stall you nothing. They like, came in.
And what was crazy is they didn't ask like hardly any questions, which actually made me nervous.
Sure.
And so I was like kind of looking, I would like come over and I'm like, so you guys got any questions? They're like, no. I'm like, okay. And they left and I went and we moved everything in. Like, shoot, it's exactly what I said. So it's like, they just, I put out on a piece of paper what it needed to look like and they did it and they left. So it was awesome.
And they are probably a team that is familiar enough with doing like light industrial that it's, they look and they're like, oh yeah, we understand what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That right there, just that alone, finding someone who understands like what the mission is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is so nice.
For sure. Yeah, it was great. And weird thing, super peripheral, but like the X7, we moved it, you know, got her wired up. It's now wired to like direct 3-phase power, so it's not phase converted anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this tool rack that's mounted to the front of it that's aftermarket, but it's like Sile stickered, but it's made in California. So it's like you can call Sile and get that front tool rack and it ships from another company in California.
Got it.
So I mounted it on there at the old shop and it used to have a tiny vibration because it's only mounted at the top at the old shop. And we put the Sile here and we were running it actually 2 days ago. And I was listening. I was like, man, that thing's rattling way harder, like that front rack. I'm like, that is concerning, right? Like, why is there a way bigger rattle now after the machine's moved? But it doesn't make sense because the machine has 3 feet, so it can't be unstable. Like, it's not, doesn't work that way.
Right.
And so I'm like, what? And then I was listening to the machine. I was like, that thing's moving faster. And it occurred to me that under a phase converter, even if the phase converter is oversized, which ours was like twice the size necessary, the motor it's a rotary phase converter, that motor has to be able to match the demand, like, and it can't do that instantly, right? And when you direct hardwire to 3-phase on a rapid move, it can ask for whatever amperage it needs and get it instantaneously,
right?
And so it's like watching the machine, there's less lag on the rapids, even though it felt fast before, but it's like way faster now. And I did not anticipate that, so it's actually like full speed now, and I didn't even know that it was actually running under speed because of it being phase converted.
It's a sweet bonus.
Yeah, I know. Like, so
extra horsepower.
And it's like fast enough that I'm like, we're going to have to take that rack off and mount it. Like, we have a place to wall mount it now. And I'm like, it's because the tools are in it, like the tools are in little holes. And so they like slide back and forth. And so, it needs some other movement, but yeah, super weird tangent, but like thinking about the power, I'm like, the benefits of having actual industrial power to industrial machines. I thought it'd just be a, you know, direct swap, but it's actually an improvement.
Just thinking about like being in the last shop, there is something about being in a commercial space that feels like very legit.
Yeah.
Do you agree? Like being in there, do you feel different?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Cause we got like a real dumpster, like industrial zoning only.
Yeah.
And we've been overwhelming the little green trash can at our house because we were just at the one residential green can and we're literally piling it high. Yeah. And then we'd have a trailer and it was like almost every other week we'd have to do a dump run in addition, just like, you know, shop stuff. You get a big thing of Kydex, you got this giant cardboard sleeve. And so we just have this dumpster and I'm like, that's perks of industrial right there. I mean, where would you put that at your house? You know, it's,
dude, shipping, receiving, there's so many little kind of benefits. That said, this morning I was in the shop and I see my door open at 6 a.m. and it's Winston.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I want to work with you.
Yeah.
I'm like, and he hung out with me for probably like 20 or 30 minutes. And we just like, I had like, I grabbed a bag of mixed like nuts and bolts. And I was like, all right, like go ahead and like assemble, like put a washer on and then like find the right nut for the right bolt. And like, he just sat at my bench and did that. Right now, that feels pretty valuable.
Mm-hmm. That is nice.
When like we were in our like offsite shop with Bo, so Bo would have been like younger than three. And like, but I guess Maddie would bring him over. Like they're mm-hmm. still around enough. Maybe it's yeah. maybe it wouldn't be an issue now. I don't know.
Yeah. 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 The where we're at with that is they, I think Becca brings the kids over like once a day at least, just cause she walks every day. And so she can yep. literally walk past here. But, Willie Wilson, he's very handsy and he's small and he doesn't,
yeah.
you know, he's two. So he just,
yeah.
he's a close watch. Delta, I think I will, once we get settled in, get Delta over here for a couple hours, like just her. So, cause she's four now and she's pretty good at like sitting down and doing something cool, you know, messing around, drawing a picture or something. So
mm-hmm.
she could probably come work here a little bit, have fun. But Willie, you know, he's a liability.
That's Winston too. He's like, yeah. he would say like, what that Sheen do? And yeah. it's like, he's looking for buttons.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. He knows what something's going to happen. And it's yeah. like, he's pretty good now. Bo is six. And so he'll get curious about things. Like I have to be careful with him if I have like a tray of parts that I'm working on, cause he'll want to like walk over and pick something up.
Yeah.
But he doesn't push buttons. He's like, he's pretty aware. Mm-hmm. Yesterday after school, he came in, he was like, hey, can I just like hang out and work? And I was like, yeah, sure. Dude, he sat there for probably an hour. Do you know what perler beads are?
Say that again.
Perler beads.
No, I don't.
Okay, so just think like 8-bit images made of like plastic. So you like have a little gridded tray and you put little beads in place and then you iron them and it gives you like an image. It's almost like,
oh, I know,
like
an image
that looks like cross stitch.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And dude, it was rad because he was like super quiet and super content. And I think he's a lot like me. And I think just coming in, he's been in school all day. He's like overstimulated, right? A lot of times he comes home and he's like wild. Mm-hmm. He came into the shop, he sat down, he was quiet. And like the rest of the day, he was like super sweet with me. Yeah. He was like pretty mellow. And I was like, okay, 100%. Like that can be a thing. I was like, yeah. you can come in anytime you want and work on your own projects, like with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, that stuff that's pretty cool. But, and that's the thing, where you're at now, like you can even put like a little bench in your office and just be like, yeah. all right, like Delta, you can hang out here, you know?
Yeah. I do plan to do that. That's a good idea.
Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and also because we do 410s, like,
yeah,
we've kind of talked about like on Fridays coming and do like some sort of house project in here. And it's like, just have the shop on Friday, ooh. Bring the kids. So we've already done that a couple times because we did so much work on the shop on the weekends that the kids like kind of know the shop just from hanging out on the weekends. Yeah. But so might think about that too. But
how, like, where are you at with space usage right now?
So obviously we have a lot of room. You know what I mean? We can echo this place, you know, pretty well. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't see limitations coming for a while. Obviously that's the famous last words and stuff, but, sure. But yeah, it's a lot of room. It's a big difference.
I was just like, even just thinking about like house projects, so just being able to have like somewhere inside to do carpentry projects.
Oh, easy. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. The center, we basically left the center bay empty. So it's
nice.
Basically 20 by 60 is empty.
Separated? So you have multiple bays? Okay.
So it's bays as in there's just posts.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's like three columns, three rows.
Right.
And so the walls, the two sides that have walls are where we basically installed everything. And yeah. so the middle is like, there's a bay door on both ends of that middle. So you can drive all the way through. And so, yeah, you could park like a 1-ton truck with like a 35-foot camper, like inside of it. It's tons of room in the middle. So
do you, this is like way jumping the gun, but like, I never stop looking at real estate. Do you look at prices for shop spaces where you're at?
I haven't, because I'm holding out, maybe yeah. overly optimistic, but I'm holding out for someday having that on my own property, like not urban, like,
yeah,
like a more rural situation.
Yeah.
And so it involved building. So that's like the dream, maybe pipe dream, but that's, I just haven't looked that much at buying like actual real estate.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's commercial, you know? So
that's kind of like for us, that's like in our 5-year is either like buy a bigger house as the boys get older and build a bigger shop, or buy a commercial space. And I don't know which way we would go, but the problem that we have is like here, commercial space is like fairly expensive.
Yeah.
Like your mill plus,
which hurts. It's not quite there, that level here, but the problem we have is like where we are, there is no commercial space in this town because it's a farming town. And so there's like 2 commercial buildings in the town. You know what I mean?
Really?
And so, yeah. And so we're in like one of the only actual commercial spaces around.
Right.
And then the only other ones are like poultry processing, and they're like 50,000 square foot.
Huge
With like
row houses.
Freezers and, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so, or like barns and stuff. So it's, if you'd have to go towards Boise, which you get into tons of industrial, the closer you get to Boise, like huge opportunity there. But
yeah, but then when you start getting into like having a commute and like all these things, like that defeats
and then,
the purpose.
And then the price in the Boise area for commercial is, I don't know for sure, but it probably rivals Bend. It's pretty off the charts.
It's pretty up there.
I've heard that because Boise's housing has been nuts, and I've heard that the commercial went even worse because everybody's trying to build houses instead. And so there's a little bit of a lopsidedness right now. So
we saw like just recently I started looking at, I forget what the commercial website is, basically like Zillow for
LoopNet.
Commercial. Yeah. LoopNet. Mm-hmm. Just recently there's properties popping up where I'm like, that is like borderline approachable, like for what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not cheap, right? Mm-hmm. But you might be getting like a newer building or like a piece of property with 3 buildings on it and like a total of 5 bays with offices and bathrooms at a price where you're like, it would cash flow. That starts, and it's like in town, that starts to be like pretty, I don't know. I'm the same way with houses. Like I, for some reason, like the ownership of a place gives me so much like stability. Shop is like kind of the same way.
I agree. That's been on my mind because we're renting this shop, obviously. So it's been the main thing where it gets me is like there's things that I would do better if I owned it,
right?
As far as like the overall setup, and like, you know, we did it, like I want everything we do in here to be a good job, like not a total liability, but it's like the nicer thing is something I would save until I owned it. You know what I mean? As far as like there's power things I could have considered, you know what I mean? But it's hard to throw money down the hole.
The amount of work that you put into it.
But no, it's been a dream, dude.
I love it.
It's much more efficient. Dalton's shipping knives right now. I have shipped all the knives up to now. And it just, that just the way our setup was over there, that was like the only option was for me to do it. And so now I can inspect, he can ship. So it's like he assembles, lays them all out on a bench. I inspect every single one, fit it in the sheath, make sure sheath fitment's good, set it back down on the order, and then it gets shipped. And so it's like,
so by the time you put a knife in the sheath, it stays in the sheath. That's
never
done.
Comes
the
out.
The fact that it's in the sheath
is inspected.
Yeah, I love that.
And so the we just put a folding table kind of as a mock-up for that because we weren't sure of the size and all that. So we pretty much decided if it was like 2 6-foot by 24-inch benches that were back to back in the middle of the room, and then on one side is all the assembled knives lining up, and then it's my job to move them to the other side, so it's not just in a sheath, but it's like on the other side, and the other side is facing the shipping side of the room. So it's like the assembly side of the room is putting it on one side, and then I'm the one that moves it across into the shipping side by inspecting it, and then it can go out. So it's like
That's a great idea.
It's just a purely visual, like, can't mess it up type of deal.
There's no mistakes, no confusion.
Yeah. And so we have like a mini warehouse, like in the corner of that room, so that it's like pick and pull type situation, with shelving, so that the shipping side is where you also box things. So like these LT5s that are coming, we're going to pre-box and sell after they're finished. And so after they've been assembled and then inspected, they pass to that shipping side where they would get boxed and put in that like racking. And the racking is right next to the shipping. So it's all kind of like a little flow. Mm-hmm. And then we use those U-line bins you might've seen on my Instagram with our knives. So blue bins are in the, we call that the clean room. Blue bins are in the clean room. Red bins are in the shop. And they don't ever intermix. And so blue bin means finished. It's like finished, maybe not necessarily assembled, but like those components are finished. And so on our spreadsheet system, we have next to every component a checkbox that turns blue when you click it. And so the thing is like if you put either like a sharpened tang that's ready to go or a set of scales or a sheath into a blue bin, you check it blue. And so on that screen, it's like blue means it's in the clean room. Mm-hmm. Not checked means it's not in the clean room. So it's like red is moving around in the shop in the dirty room, dirty side. Blue is on the clean side that's finished. And it has been a really cool little system. We never were able to do it before.
Sounds like it.
Only had one space. So it was like we had color coding, but it became difficult because it's like we had to stack bins on top of each other that were like all different stuff. And so now it's like, no, it goes right here.
Like, I think that's one of the areas that when you think about shop space isn't necessarily like the most obvious, which is it's not just the space for work. It's the space for ideas and to like you said, it's like a small warehouse.
Yeah.
The fact that you can start to learn and implement concepts that could be scaled, I think is one of the biggest benefits where you start to think about space in a different way.
Yeah.
We've talked about like my shop a little bit where I'm like, yeah, I'm like in this weird middle ground right now, because on one hand I've got all this like old materials and like random hardware and stuff that like as a creative is awesome to have around, but for a productive like business or product line, serves no purpose. It has no purpose in day-to-day operation of like the majority of things that I'm making. If the space is there, that's not an issue, because then you essentially have like a cell that is for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a little bit of a like experimentation cell. Yeah,
totally. Or you have like, you know, it's like right now I'm like, I've got a welding table in my shop. I'm not welding all the time, but I need to build things occasionally. If you have more space, you can have a maintenance area, and it all, I just like to compartmentalize stuff that way where you're like, okay, cool. Yep. If we need to build a workbench and we need to build a table, like all those tools are there. I'm not going to the same toolboxes that have knife making tools and like borrowing things out. As I say this, I realize that even at the scale that I'm at, I can still compartmentalize more than I am. Probably, which is kind of fun, but I think space, like really, it's like your brain expands. You're just like, here's all these areas that we can play with. It's pretty cool.
And we used to have like, we do the Kanban thing. And so you have your inventory that you're pulling from, and then you have the backup inventory. And the backup inventory, we used to have a very hard time like sorting through it because we couldn't fully organize it. So they were kind of in like totes. So it's like, oh, I need this specific screw. You'd have to go like dig. And now it's like a Kanban shelf, like a 6 foot tall shelf.
Right. I need to come out and visit. I really do.
I'd love to have you out. And you can definitely pull your truck in and pop the camper. There's a bathroom.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Just roll right inside. Yeah. I think especially for the type of work that you're doing, that ability to just be like, okay, this efficiency now has the space that it needs.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
And is amazing.
It really felt like that. It was like at the old shop, the vision and the idea was already in place, but it was like crumpled up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was like, yeah, it would work, but it's like, it doesn't actually work when you don't have anywhere to put the bins.
Right.
And so it was kind of like a theoretical partially right. idea. And then now it's like, no, that's actually how it works. Like,
how tall are your ceilings?
So there's beams and stuff. The lowest part of the beam is 13 feet. And then the actual ceiling is between like 14 and 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think our last shop, the ceilings might have been like 16 or 18 feet. And I always That's had high. This thing of like, it would be sick to just have like a drone that could like roll around on its own and just like take shop video.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a pre-programmed path. You're like, all right, you're going to go like every 45 minutes and like go to these areas and like record footage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Seemed cool. Never did it.
Yeah. That'd be fun to fly a little drone.
I did buy a drone though. And I did try to take shop video, but it didn't stick. That's full ADHD.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I want to try it because for now, my office and the clean room have like open air because we built 8-foot walls around them. Actually, most of the wall was already existing, so that's not all the way to the ceiling. So you could fly a drone like over the clean room and then back over the shop, like without hitting anything.
It's kind of cool. I don't know, additional content. Kind of fun.
Yeah, no, that'd be fun. Yeah, we might have to raise those walls to the ceiling. But it would be for like dust reasons. So we wouldn't necessarily like fully frame it 2x4s and stuff. We'd probably just use like some sort of barrier. They make this, it's basically the exact shape as cardboard in terms of like the corrugation, but it's actually like white plastic.
Yep.
And we were thinking about exactly putting that up to the ceiling so that it's like, you just see this white panel that's just air just blocking dust.
That's a pretty good idea. Do you have, it's weird to ask now because you have so much more space, but do you have a mist buster?
No,
on your machines?
I don't. Only the one runs coolant, so it's the only one that would need it.
Right.
We don't have mist issues right now because we're running small diameter tools and hydraulic holders. Hydraulic holders are really good for like mitigating mist because they're perfectly circular.
Right.
And so like it seems like the hydraulic holders it's not a problem.
Don't need it as much. Right. Because so like I'm running like ER collets and like they've got nuts. And so
it's like a little turbo fan.
Yeah. Coolant hits it, splatters all over.
Yeah.
So you're running hydraulic for all tools?
All but one. Only reason being is like the tool that we like for our chamfers is double ended.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, it's like the ER or the hydraulic holder doesn't really like the double ended tools.
Okay.
It like doesn't fit. It doesn't feel right when it's in there.
Right.
Which kind of makes sense. Cause if like the inside of a hydraulic holder, it's like the walls are bowing in to like compress.
Right, to like hold.
And
that.
So it's like, if it's double ended, it's kind of like, it just
got some,
it
weirdness.
Worried me enough to where we have kept that one in an ER call it as other than that, it's hydro.
What tool holders are you using?
Meritool. Yeah. Yeah, Meritool hydro holders. Yeah, they have Cat 40 and BT30 and everything we need.
I'll look at that. It's funny. Like,
they're awesome.
So last week, basically, I started gearing up for show season. So I'm going to do Blade Show Atlanta, and I'm doing Billy Cho's Pacific Northwest Custom Invitational. Mm-hmm. I always get that like messed up. PNWCI.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of get ready for them simultaneously. And it's interesting, man. I don't know if I'm like some of this stuff is like learning just through osmosis and like conversations with you or like Jens or just, but as I'm going through my processes now, I'm seeing these areas where I'm like, oh, I could like do that in a more accurate way. And I'm like, how do I know that though? Like, where am I getting that? It's just interesting. Cause I haven't been machining a ton lately. It's both frustrating and super exciting.
I've listened to every single episode since the very first one of the Business of Machining podcast. And I gotta say, I've learned a lot of osmosis through them because John Grimsmo is one of them and he's a knife maker. So there's that contextual thing. But I actually like the fact that John Saunders doesn't know a thing about knives other than that he just likes them because he's doing something totally different. And it's like the ideas, it's like he's kind of more down that like Jay Pearson track of like hyper efficient like billet aluminum manufacturing. And more classical machine shop type situation. And so it's just been cool to just learn.
Okay. I will. I've listened to like episodes like off and on, but I've just never, I listened to, that's actually a good question for you too. Okay. So basically I listen to a lot of tech and a lot of investing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What podcasts, like what genre area do you like listen to most frequently?
I bounce around, but I really like Lex Friedman. I don't know if you ever listen to Lex.
I just listening to Lex Friedman.
Yeah, Lex is legit. And Business and Machining, and then Carbide Content, which I think Grant might listen to our podcast. And here's a reminder, Grant, you guys need to post another episode. And I know I'm not the one that should be saying that, but I'm just
3 weeks late.
I'm just saying I miss the old Carbide Content. That's a good one. So
it's pretty fun.
Yeah, that's I used to listen to more podcasts before I had Dalton in the shop, and then it just got to where it's like when you're working with people, it's a little bit weird to listen to something long form like that. I don't do it as much. I always wear I wear noise canceling headphones all day, every day, but I've gone to where I just turn them on and leave them on noise cancel and not play anything. Cause if someone tries to talk to me, it's just better.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm listening to a lot.
Yeah.
Although I've been like forcing myself to listen to music again. Cause I think it's interesting. It's almost like social media sometimes where I'm like, I want something there, but I'm like, I actually don't need this. Like, and I'll notice it with like certain conversations where I'm like, why am I listening to this? I'm actually this episode is like not interesting to
me. Yeah.
It's just 2 hours background noise. And I'm
realize
like,
that. Yeah.
Yeah. I should probably just listen to music or like turn it off.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Sometimes you can overdo it, or I have on that, on the like just information just pouring
over,
especially when it's like, yeah, this is really not what I care about, and I already listened to an hour of it or whatever. I've had that,
like too many things.
You gotta be careful about that. But Business and Machining, that's where I've kind of absorbed a lot. The hydro holders, I highly recommend them. I think one of the biggest benefits for us besides the mist is, said this before, but like tool changing. Like when the tool wears out, we have like a map of our tool life. So it's like, as soon as we hit this many of on this tool, it just changes. So we don't have to, it's earlier than when the finish would be like problematic. Like, unless something bad happens.
How did you develop that process?
Just in the beginning, just running them in every part, looking at the finish, like looking at the chamfer, looking at the perimeter, looking at the jimping. And then eventually it was like in the first couple of batches, I was like, okay, this tool starts to die at about like 52 parts almost every time. And at about like 48, it's starting to get a little bit washed out.
And then so from there you'll get a chip or something.
So I draw that back like a few knives prior to that happening. And so, and we got to where a lot of them were hovering around like 40 to like 50, sometimes as much as 60, but we ended up with like the main body of tools that we use, just doing them all at 40. So that it's like you're just keeping track.
Yeah. So
easily.
I've never done that. Like I'm not doing the numbers that you're doing, so I don't have the data, but I will watch for finish specifically. And there's certain jobs where I know like, okay, like I'm going to wear this out faster, but I'm not rotating all of my tools at the same time. It's like, I've got like little carbide, you know, like circuit board drills that, I mean, if I don't break them, they run. Like they're probably run hundreds of parts.
Yeah. I will say like all of our carbide stuff, because it's like you're doing the perimeter, then you're doing the chamfer, and it's like they end up wearing out about the same time ish.
Yeah.
But like our drills are, we definitely change earlier than we need to.
Yeah,
but I found that just using high speed drills instead of carbide is like perfectly acceptable. And they cost like $2 a piece.
Yeah.
So it's like, could I get twice as many as what I'm getting? Probably, but like it's really easy to just like, all right, tool change over time, change out the carousel one at a time, just go through, do it
right
back in business. And then that's where I was talking about with the hydros, is if you're going to change like 7 tools in a row, it really adds up, like taking collets apart, blowing them out, wiping them down, retorquing. So it's like you change that tool, it's in the spindle, you literally just stick the Allen straight in the hydro, like in the spindle. You just let the tool drop into your hand, stick the new one in, tighten it, next tool. And so it's like, you don't, You don't
no torque spec. Do you actually, like, if you're using like an ER collet, do you torque it?
I don't, and I have a really nice torque wrench. And the reason I don't torque it is I found that the torque specs for those is way tighter than what I ever want or have needed to.
Yeah, it's freaky.
I've tightened it that tight, and then I go to undo it, and I'm like, dude, my freaking bench is moving. Like, I can't. So I've just never had pullout issues because I'm not. I think if you're hogging like aluminum and you have like a large chip load and like a heavy cut, that's where those torque specs come from. But when you're doing stainless steel and titanium, like, you're not, you know, 2 inches deep into a block, like, trying to hold on to
something
that tool.
Grabby.
Yeah. And so I just, like I said, we just have only the one ER chuck that we use regularly, and we just hand tighten it basically till it stops, and like, just one little pull. And I know it's under spec, so I'm not hurting anything, because I did torque it to where I was like, okay, we're definitely not over tightening it, you know.
So if you're running drills, are you running, and you're running those in hydraulic?
Oh, I do run those two drills in drill chucks.
Okay.
Because they're, you know, you could kind of consider doing it in a hydro, but they're weird diameters.
I was gonna say, that's one of the reasons, like, for a lot of my small drills, I run with a 1/8 shank.
Yeah.
And that's like the nice thing about circuit board drills is, like, I've got a, you know, a 32nd drill bit up to like 1/100 thou or 1/8 of an inch, and they're all an 1/8 of an inch shank.
That's amazing. Yeah, hydro holder would be perfect for that. I know that there's a Cat 40 1/8 inch hydro holder that they make. So it's like a giant holder with this little tiny hole in it, and it's
pretty sexy.
It is sweet. But yeah, we use the drill chucks, and they don't mist either, because those are super low RPM. When you're using a decent sized drill, 2 flute, pretty low RPM. So,
something to think about. I sent you pictures of the inside of my machine yesterday. We were talking about coolant.
Yeah.
And that, dude, it's really strange. So back in New Mexico, I just used tap water. Never had a problem. No buildup. Coolant was super, super clean. And I use this Hangster Furs, which it's awesome too. Like, you can use it for surface grinding. Like, it has, it's so much range.
It's like vegetable based.
Yeah. It's vegetable based, non-toxic. Like, it doesn't give you skin problems. Like, it's amazing.
That's awesome.
But on Cape and in Bend, I get this like nasty brown buildup inside of my machine. And I think it's hard water, and like, barring using distilled, I haven't figured out a solution for it.
So here's what I would like to do, because we get a little, I get a little bit of hard water on like the inside of our coolant tank, which concerns me. But it hasn't been an issue, other than that, like, 10 years in the future, is that just going to be like crusty. You can get an RO filter off Amazon that's like designed for like your house.
Yep.
And then what you can do is just hook up like line pressure to it, and then fill up like a big tote. And then it's like, you're not going to get like your full volume of like tap water. So it would take forever. Yeah. So if you have like a, you know, get a blue, you know, 55 gallon drum and just fill it with water, and then use that. And then
use that.
Yeah.
I'm usually adding like, I'll add 5 gallons at a time. This is the thing. Okay. And I don't have like the experience of a number of coolants in like high production capacity environments to know if this is rare or not. But like, dude, I very rarely ever change my coolant. Like, my coolant lasts forever. Like, every 2 or 3 years, maybe.
Yeah.
But I mean, literally all I do is top it off. Like, 5 gallon bucket of water, add, you know, 4 ounces or whatever it is, a coolant to bring it up to 3%, add the 3% to the now, you know, concentrated 10% that's in my coolant tank.
Yeah.
Clean the chips. I've got a skimmer, and it goes forever.
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody could tell me that I'm doing it wrong, but like, it doesn't smell. It seems like my tool life is good. Pretty neat.
That Hangsterfer sounds good. We've had good luck with ours, but the reason I texted you this week about your Hangsterfer's coolant, here's why. Weird other situation. So we pull our knives out of the tumbler, and we're getting to where we put like quite a bit of knives in there. And we have found that obviously the water in a tumbler is going to be super hard water no matter what you do, because it's grinding stones the whole time. So it's like, if we pull a bunch of knives out, and if you just like are at all lackadaisical about like getting them clean and oiled, they will get hard water marks on them that is actually very difficult to remove. Mm-hmm. Just drying out. And so you'll be like, you'll wipe off the dust and it'll just be like a little bit of a streak that's like, what the heck? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like your fridge door when the water just turns it white. Like that's what happens on our knives. So we've been doing like where you literally open the tumbler and you pull one out at a time, blow it off, yep. oil it. And it's yep. like, it's too slow. Like we just, it's taking too long. And so we, what, here's what we did is we got an ultrasonic cleaner and we put those divider racks inside of it, like what our bins hold. So it's like,
oh,
you can fit 25 knives in this ultrasonic, like perfectly lined up. And then what we were doing is putting like any kind of detergent in there or whatever. We started with dish soap, which I actually really like for this. And so we'd ultrasonic them real quick for like 5 minutes out of the tumbler. And so when you pull it out of the tumbler and you set it in there, it doesn't get a chance to dry out.
Right.
So as long as it's wet, because it's magna cut, it's not going to rust. As long as it's yeah. wet, it's not going to get the hard water.
Yeah.
And then as long as you're pulling them out of there one at a time and oiling them, then you're better off. But here's the thing. If we thought about if you took and you use that ultrasonic cleaner full of coolant instead of soap, the coolant could be the actual oil that blocks the dry out. And so it's like, what if you ran an ultrasonic coolant with that Hangstrafers in it that would not only like kind of disturb that media and get them clean, but then you drip dry them and they wouldn't get hard water stained because it's oily. You know what I mean?
That's an interesting idea.
And the reason we were talking about Hangstrafers is it's a knife that could theoretically be used for food prep. And sure. I don't want to, because like if you just put a regular machine coolant in there, then it's like, what, you have to ultrasonic clean it again.
Right.
Else you're like putting non-food safe stuff on a knife. So I'm like, because we only use food safe lube on like.
So like arguably you could use, like, it sounds weird, but you could like use vegetable oil. You could try that.
The only problem I have is that if it's just straight oil, it's
weird. Yeah.
It is going to be way too oily because yeah. You're going to have to like literally dry it with like 20,000 paper towels. But if you use coolant, because it's water soluble, it's only going to be like, you know, 5% or 8% or whatever. And mm-hmm. so it doesn't, like, you know, if you pull something out of a machine and you let it air dry on a bench, you don't like literally look at it and it's like covered in oil. It just leaves like a tiny microfilm once the water evaporates. And so
I like in the back of my head, I feel like there is a product.
Yes.
That is almost specifically for this that I think is a better solution than Hangstrafers in this case, because what you're going to get, you're still going to get evaporation and you still have water in it.
Yeah.
So the potential for rust exists, and also just kind of like a slightly more annoying amount of maintenance than you may want. There is something.
And so that brings me up the point of like, okay, so if you order a knife made out of D2 that has a satin finish on it.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like a Scotch-Brite satin finish. Yeah. Shows up in the box looking dry, but it's not rusted. What is on that? Because it's like if they're like those large manufacturers, they can't just be sitting there with the rags like wiping them down. You know what I mean? Like, what is the mechanized way to put a film that is food safe on those, like on a utensil, like, you know, a kitchen?
It's gotta be like a wax base,
yeah,
or something.
And how is it applied? Because like that's where we were trying to circle around it, because oiling, you know, 25 to 50 knives one at a time and like rubbing it in and wiping it off, it sucks. It's just not cool. So
the wipe, I was gonna say, the one thing you could do, we've talked about I forget what they're called, but basically it's a spray can with a Schrader valve. So you open it up, you pour whatever you want. I use them for WD-40. So mm-hmm. I pour my WD-40 in, I charge it to 90 PSI, and you basically get a spray can.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
You could put any food safe spray in there. And then the beauty of that is like, you lay all the knives out, you spray them. So case study for this would be like when I do SciPops, I'm like this morning, I pulled brass SciPops out of the tumbler. Same exact issue. So mm-hmm. I take air, I dry them off. I have a rag in my other hand. I like dry off any additional kind of like moisture. I lay them down. Soon as I finish the batch, I spray them all with WD-40, flip them, spray them. And then they sit there until I'm ready to basically go to final finish. at which case I dry them. But that's a lot of touching each piece.
Yeah, that, and see, that's where we're at, is like what we're doing works.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, every time the tumbler is like, oh, we just hit our time mark, we got to pull them out. It's like, put down everything you're doing. Like, it's this big project
right.
to get knives out of the tumbler. And I'm like, obviously in a big facility, this is not a project, because if they're pulling 1,000 knives out of a tumbler, they're not oiling and wiping
each
1,000 knives, right? Like,
I wonder if they're tumble drying. The only problem with that is I feel like you could increase the risk of like scratching.
Yeah.
But they have tumbler setups that are specifically for drying parts.
But the only problem is it has to be cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be cleaned first. And that isn't super easy to do, because if you use an ultrasonic, like, it's going to continue, like, it'll be clean once. Like, if you put distilled water in it, it'll be clean that first time.
Yeah.
Then the next batch, it will not be clean. It'll be hard water. So that's where we're at, is like, so
the thought is really interesting.
Like, the thought is, if you had a machine coolant like water soluble oil, either Hangstrafer's or something like that, you take the knives out, you put them directly into those slots, like I said, in the ultrasonic.
Yeah.
You run the ultrasonic for a second, it kind of disturbs the solution and mm-hmm. and gets some of that media off the knife. Then you could just lift that basket out, let it drip dry, and then send them straight to sharpening. You know what I mean? Is the thought. So you're not actually touching a knife other than to get it out of the tumbler.
Okay.
That's
I want to think on this
conceptual
one some more.
But if
yeah.
anyone's
are
listening,
are you using any compound in your tumbler? Like, do you use like a burnishing compound?
We don't.
Okay. So that might be an intermediate step, mm-hmm. is to use like super sun sheen.
Yeah.
I will send you an image, because it's basically a detergent.
Yeah.
But one thing it does is it helps your media stay clean and cut more consistently.
That's useful. I should definitely look into that.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I've seen that used, and I don't know. I never really dug into it, but
yeah,
I definitely need to look into it.
And then the only other thing like that I've been kind of wondering about is Burr King has. So like, I've got a 5-gallon bucket with an aquarium pump, basically. Okay. I keep the aquarium pump elevated off the bottom of the bucket, but I can watch the finish of parts change as it gets loaded with ceramic.
It does.
Okay. Yep. Burr King makes like a pre-filter seems like it could be pretty interesting. And like a lot of this stuff can be like hacked together. It's like people running like whole house filters on their CNC.
Yeah.
Right.
One thing, here's a thought. One thing I have seen multiple people do is they have water that comes into the tumbler.
Yeah.
Straight out off the water line. So there's no pump at all. It's just water coming straight out of the house.
Yeah.
And then it's just collected and it's just wastewater.
Yeah. And they make tumbling systems that are like, you could have a gravity feed water. Like, so your water's up above.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have 5 gallons on a drip system, and then it drips through the system into another
filter.
And that's it. And then you trash that.
Yeah.
I'm like used to living in deserts, and it's like a weird thing to probably like hang my hat on, but I'm like, oh, I'm going to like make my water last.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, and it probably does not matter at all.
Right.
But you don't need to change it every single time.
Yeah. Yeah. We've
like
found
you can probably get like 10 batches out of the tumbler on like one mix of water. Then it's like you're tooling.
Yeah.
You just know, like, all right, if I wait this long, now it starts to get a rough finish.
I've gotten to where I can look at the bucket and be like, ah, it's too much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause it's like, you can just see it. It's like, it's too milky, too cloudy.
Too milky. Exactly.
And it just, the finish gets more gray on the knife. I've noticed
exactly.
Like it goes from being sheen to being dull. And then it doesn't abrade the sandblast. If you're pre-blasting, it doesn't abrade it as deep, as far.
Yeah.
And so I think part
it's
of why
essentially insulating it.
Yeah, exactly. It's preventing abrasion. And so they may be more gray actually because there's actually just less abrasion, so there's more sandblast remaining.
I think first step, I think try a burnishing compound,
mm-hmm.
because I think it'll make your media and your, do we call
so,
it, I guess it's coolant, but it's not like,
right.
You know, whatever your tumbling compound juice is.
Slurry. Yeah.
Yeah. Your slurry.
But the only problem I agree. The only problem is we still got to oil them. And that's the problem, you know? So it's like, how can we not manually oil them? So I'm curious about the Hangstrafers. If we can do, like I said, dip ultrasonic in Hangstrafers, air dry with the right ratio of that, would it just work without touching them? You know what I mean? It's curious. Because I know
if I could test it for you here just with some 5%.
Right. Well, I mean, half the reason you run machine coolant, other than coolant and chip evacuation, is if you're running steel parts, they just come out naturally insulated, right? Like, as long as you're not stacking them where the water can't evaporate,
right?
As long as they're air exposed, unless it's straight up, you know, pure iron, it's you just don't our our soft steel blanks, mm-hmm. they come out of the machine, they could sit for months straight out of the machine and they never are going to rust. And it's because they have that 8% of the coolant in the water remains permanently.
Right. What coolant are you using now?
It's Omida is the brand. And it's just so there's a Haas dealership here in town. Yeah. And then they're an adjunct with a Eclipse Tool is the company. So it's a tooling company and a Haas distributor together. And they just say we just recommend this to everybody. They've got 50 buckets of it in their front room. So it's it just seems it's the Boise thing. It's just you go down there and get the Omida that they have. And I assume they have their reasons, but I wasn't going to, you walk into the front desk and you're standing next to this pile of buckets. I'm like, what am I going to argue with them?
I don't want that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
so it is.
What is is it Blazer? Is the Blazer the one that is water clear?
There's another one that starts with an S, I forget, but there's a couple that are straight, look like water, which I don't like.
It is disturbing.
Freaks me out.
I like my weird blue alien goop.
Yeah.
It lets me know. I can look at it and be like, oh yeah, this level of blue, it's too rich.
Yeah.
Or it's okay, it's turning green. Now it means the water's evaporating.
Yeah. I see the clear, on a machine table, just clear water running across them, cringe, dude. Oh,
you just want to go wipe it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, what's the other one? Anyway, I can't remember, but
there's Swiss Lube or
Synergy.
Blazer, Synergy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I'm super, the Omida I've had in the style, I've not found a reason to change it.
Yeah.
It's just, I know that it's not necessarily food grade,
right?
Or it's not necessarily crazy toxic, but it's not I don't want to put it on an Overland.
Do you ever have any skin problems? Do your hands ever get?
Dalton mentioned it.
Yeah.
He's like, I have a red mark. It was the first week.
So and if then, he's getting that, be careful.
So I need to check in with him again because that was a year ago. And
it's basically psoriasis kind of deal. It can create skin infections.
I'll make sure. Cause I told him, dude, if that happens again, we're switching the coolant. And then I think it was just
one time.
It happened one time. So I don't know if that's related, but we should definitely, mm-hmm. for that reason, I would consider going to the Hangstrafers in the machine as well.
Yeah.
I'll look into it for sure.
That was one of the shop that I worked in that ran screw machines. They use I remember their oil, it is straight up oil.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Smelled like oil, looked like oil, and the machinists, a lot of times their hands were jacked up. And then there was we would get these blooms of algae and stuff. And I was I just want no part of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that stuff actually is oil. It's like those screw machines. It's straight. A 55 gallon drum of actual oil.
I know, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can smell it if I think about it.
They have to have fire suppression on those machines because it doesn't have water in it. That stuff will burn. Oh. So, yeah.
Dude, we went super nerdy machinist stuff today. That was kind of fun.
Yeah. No kidding. I like it.
Unintended tangent.
Yeah. I like it, though. Yeah. It's a good one. First recording in the new shop.
Congrats.
It's been good. It's been good. But right. I'm glad the old hotspot held up. That was
dude, that's amazing.
Concerning. Yeah, dude. This like Verizon hotspot. Like it's been, I've been using my phone to give Wi-Fi to the whole shop. Like I said, the shop's 60 feet long. If my phone's in the front corner, it's giving Wi-Fi to the whole shop with like no lag. And it's just good.
That's
I'm like,
great.
It's really impressed, actually. I thought it was going to be a total like rough experience to use hotspot until they set that up. But
yeah,
I will
solid.
say this, we're hooking up with cable internet.
Nice.
Sparklight is the company, but it's like coaxial cable based. They're setting us up with a 1 gig download speed, which I don't know. I'm like, do you have like a lesser one? I mean, is that expensive?
Like, I don't know if I need that.
They're like, I mean, that's your industrial. Like, that's just standard. And I'm like, shoot, I guess I'll download like 40 gigabytes a day,
everything.
Like easily. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's 1 gig down is like, I think our house where we were was like 200 megabytes down and it was fast.
Yeah.
And it's like five times that. It's crazy. If it actually is that, I'll do a speed test. They may be BSing me, but next week.
Close. Something.
Next week, we'll do a speed test on the pod and we'll see what we actually get.
Sounds good. We should be good, like get back on a weekly schedule, I think. Like,
yeah.
For a little while. Holy cow, man.
Yeah. Things are cooling down over here. We're finally, like, tomorrow's Friday, and we were four, so it's like I can actually look at Friday and be like, yeah, I'm gonna go hang out with the kids, go do some stuff.
Amazing.
It's feel good, because it was like, you know, 45 days straight of like move, 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 move.
7 days a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. And stretch, man. Yeah. All right, man. Congratulations, guys. Thank you for listening to this episode. Sorry about the delay and the gap. It's life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how it goes. I appreciate you guys. Thanks for those in Patreon, all that.
Yep.
You guys are awesome.
Let us know if there's anything you guys want us to talk about or got questions on what we're working on, anything like that.
Heck yeah. Peace.
All right. Take it easy.